Hey everybody, I'm Josh Udall, and on this episode, we have Nick Woodman with us. We will be talking about what user experience is and what the foundational principles are in order to create a positive experience for your customers and or users. I kind of go way back to I think probably about a good 3 or 4 years ago now. It's what it feels like. As I was a student at NASCAD, being a design student, I did an internship at MindSea, which is where Nick was working at the time, and he actually helped teach me a lot of the UX foundational principles that I've come to learn and come to know. So I thought it was super important, super awesome to bring him in and let you guys know what UX is all about. So to start off, like, what is your background, Nick, and what is kind of how long you've been in the industry for?
Sure, yeah. So my formal education is in graphic design and web development. So I studied at the Center for Arts and Technology, studied around from 2012 to 2014. And I guess you could say that's kind of when it all really began. I got into mobile product design and UX research kind of by accident. Originally kind of thought that what I'd be doing is more print design. I thought that portion of my degree would be what I primarily focused on, doing marketing materials, branding stuff, promotions, posters, maybe product packaging and the like. But really, once we got into the web development side of my degree, that's when I started to see kind of how powerful that web can be. And just being able to have an idea, use HTML to prototype it and get it right in front of people was pretty powerful for me at the time, especially being younger, going through school. So in regards to that, like, we had a project at school where we needed to develop a web app. It was a group project. So we took on this idea called Foodscapes, which allowed Haligonians to find a place to eat. So it started off where you tell them what, or the user would tell the app what part of the city that they're in. So North End or downtown or et cetera, right? And then you would choose what you're craving. Burgers, seafood, some snack food or the like. And then it would generate a list of places to go. It wasn't a lot in there because it wasn't hooked up to a database or CMS of any kind. It was all manual, static stuff.
Nice, so, come on.
Yeah, so there wasn't a lot there, but we had some photos and some ratings that we gave it ourselves and some menu items and prices. And we had to do some user testing for that too. And I guess that's how it truly all began, was with that one school project.
Fantastic. And what school was it again?
That was at the Center for Arts and Technology.
And from what I remember, we talked about before, remember that program being pretty rigorous, and it took a lot of work and a lot of effort.
There were some long days, yeah. Every course was 3 hours long, and some days you would have basically three back-to-back classes with like one 15-minute break thrown in between there to grab a bite to eat. So it was quite long some days.
Dang, dude. That's welcome to doing design right there. That is the essential of what it's all about. Yeah. So I think you may have already answered this question, but like, what motivated you to sign up for the Center of, Center for Arts and Technology and jump into it now? I guess it's Da Vinci College now.
Da Vinci, but, yeah. It was rebranded. Mm-hmm. So how that all started was I actually, before that, I was at SMU, St. Mary's, studying psychology. That's what I thought I was going to do an undergrad in. And I guess I love to try and understand how people think and, the reasons behind their behavior and their actions. And a couple months in, I realized that at the time I was young too at the time, of late birthdays in the summer going in. So I just kind of thought it wasn't for me at the time. So I took a year off to think about it, went back to digital art school. And during that summer that I was off, I actually did a lot of recording, music recording, and was designing my own album artwork. And that's kind of how I got into the graphic design side of it. But then when I got into school and saw that there's a whole web portion of my degree as well, that's kind of where it took off into the more digital product.
That makes a lot of sense. Yeah. Especially I could really understand you getting into being interested in the UX side of it because of your psychology background.
It came full circle. Yeah. Like I didn't have much of a background at that point. I didn't study it very long, but it was just the interest in it. And I think that's where my passion for it still resides, is in trying to understand the motivation behind people, their goals, their actions, and then translating that into like a usable product for them.
That's so cool. And we gotta love when kind of life just works that way, right?
Yeah.
You end up finding something, you find your niche and you get right into it. But you talked about how you did that school project and you did some usability testing. So what took place in that? Like, what was usability testing?
Yeah, so this was not as thorough as it should have been at the time when you're learning all of this. But, you know, at the time it was just kind of asking people what they thought about it. But as I progressed in my career of being a mobile product designer, after I left school, product testing and user research, that's a lot of like you're scheduling around 8 participants. Ideally, that's for qualitative trends, that's around the number that you're looking to interview. And you're just running them through a test script that essentially is a series of falsifiable hypotheses that you're trying to either prove true or false. Because when you're designing, you're making a lot of assumptions. And you want to not validate those. You don't want to prove that they're right. You want to test them to see if they are right or wrong. And that's what the whole idea behind it is running people through wireframes and testing user flows and then putting visual design in front of them and getting a sense of feedback on branding. And that's a lot of what it was.
So what I'm understanding is the huge aspect to it is eliminating bias. And so what is the huge cost that a company is going to pay if they say don't do any usability testing and try to go off their bias?
The thing with user testing is that it's data-driven design. So if you're in a room with a group of stakeholders and they're suggesting that you do X, but you know Y is the better option because you have the data to back it up, like that's the power that comes with the user research, is that expert power, is being able to actually say, we've reviewed this with our actual target audience and they are less confused about the screen, or if it's a product page, like they're more willing to buy a product, we will more likely increase sales if we redesign it this way. And that's when the business side starts to listen, is when you have qualitative trends, and in the better situations, qualitative data, maybe from analytics, you're testing with a large group of beta testers to actually prove which flow is best, what interface is working better, even testing colors. This color button is more interactive than another.
Mm. Yeah, that's huge. And data-driven design is humongous. And that's actually one thing, even with us as a company at WhatsOn, is in the early days, especially when I first started, you know, even myself as a designer, I was just starting to learn the UX game and trying to get my head around it. And a lot of things, what would happen is we would be in meetings and the word like would be thrown around a lot. Like, I like it this way and I like it that way. And realizing that it was our bias and what we perceived thought would be the good idea, which always messed us over in the long run, because we'd implement it into our product and then realize with a live product that actually the user didn't actually want that, and then it cost us in the long run. It cost us months worth of work. Mm-hmm. So actually getting those usability testing in, figuring out what the users actually want is humongous.
Yeah, and it's important to use your own product for the sake of usability, but a lot of the time, you're not your users or your target audience. And that's where that bias comes in, right?
Right, for sure. So I know we kind of already dug deep down into, we've already kind of, we're already like neck deep into UX talk right now. So I'm sorry to the listeners who aren't as well known or well versed. So we'll kind of rewind a little bit. And I'll ask the question to you, Nick, is what is user experience and what is the benefit for a company to focus on it?
Sure. So that's like a rabbit hole that we could have a whole like 4 hour talk on,
yes,
right?
Yeah.
But I think to simply state it in a way that's pretty succinct is just to say it's inclusive design. UX is more than just designing products for the people that are going to use them. It's the actual understanding that while you may be designing a product for a target audience, that target audience is incredibly diverse.
Mm.
If you think about product users for Facebook, I mean, by no means do I actually understand or like know the rationale behind their design decisions, but their users are essentially almost everybody. It's incredibly diverse, and it's actually trying to understand the goals within their specific products, and they do a good job of actually breaking out their core business into many different smaller products in order to better refine that. But it's truly understanding what the goals are, the actions that users want to take to perform their goals and get to the end state, essentially.
Right. So say someone, you know, he's like, say someone goes to their boss of their company and is like, yes, we need to focus on UX. That's something we definitely need to focus on. It seems like that's the hot button word that people are using nowadays. We should do some UX. You know,
just buy some UX.
Yeah, buy yourself some UX. I need 10 of them.
Yeah.
What is the actual benefit, though, for a company to focus on UX?
So it's empathy and understanding. It's compassion. It's actually seeing the world through your user's eyes. It's getting into their shoes, essentially, trying to understand their mental models, their language, how they think about things. A term that we use is code books. So like what symbols and artifacts and language and terms do they associate with things, right? If a great example is like if someone told us both to draw a tree right now, guaranteed we both have two different drawings on the page, right? Because we both have different preconceptions of what a tree is. And it's understanding that idea for your audience, for your users, so that you can actually give them the true value that they want.
Right. It's like a huge part of it is realizing that every individual is different, as you said about the tree example.
Yeah.
And thus we live in a world, and especially a tech world, where everything's all about personalization. You know, we all want to make sure we give everyone a very distinct and personal experience with whatever they're using. And that kind of has started drifting into a lot of different areas, not just tech. I'm totally lost my train of thought.
That happens all the time.
I love it, man. I love when this happens. So, I mean, I guess at the end of the day, UX is important. It's important to make sure that, you know, as the research has gone, it's important to be personalizing things, going after people individually and what they actually want and need. As we've seen with Facebook and other different social media outlets, they've kind of made their products very diverse, as you said earlier, and going after those things. So from what you've learned and going forward in the UX field, what are some foundational principles that someone needs to follow in the UX?
So I hope that you'll let me go on a little bit of a rant here.
Go for it, man. Go for it.
I read the Dieter Rams biography once, As Little Design as Possible. Have you read that?
I have not read it. Yeah. I've probably read the first few pages, but I definitely want to get into it.
It's a big book, but I recommend you and the listeners to read that if they have a chance to. He states in that, you know, his heart belongs to the details, that they're actually more important than the big picture, because the big picture doesn't work without the details. He says that they're everything, and that they're the baseline of a product's quality. So in terms of foundational principles. A lot of the, I guess you could say, non-foundational principles of today are the way they are because they're quite trendy. People do things because one product does it, another copies it. You're seeing that a lot with this new stories idea. You see that on Snapchat, on Instagram, and the Score app just copied that same model.
No way.
Yeah, and now their team news and their feed, they just did a redesign today, and they're using the exact same paradigm that circles along the top. You can scroll horizontally, and you can see all your team's news quickly that way.
And sorry, I just want to interrupt you for 2 seconds. Yeah. To our American listeners, the Score is actually a Canadian sports app and website. So just those who don't know what the Score is, it's a sports website, kind of like your ESPN, something like that. But yeah, continue.
Right. So anyway, there's a lot of these trendy, like, trends, I guess, right? These trendy principles that people are starting to use. But if I had to list out foundational principles, I would just copy them right from Dieter Rams out of his book, his 10 Principles of Good Design. And that's that good design is innovative. New technologies are always being developed. And as a result, you have the opportunity to design for those new technologies. So it's constantly innovative. Good design makes a product useful. Good design always emphasizes the usefulness of a product, and it disregards anything that could actually distract from that. His third is that good design is aesthetic, that products are used every day by people, and they actually have an effect on their lives, an emotional effect, and that aesthetic quality is important because of that. Good design also makes a product understandable. So we always wireframe before we jump into visual design, and that's so that we ensure that the structure is appropriate, that the information flows the right way, and that the product's useful before we start to apply branding or paint to it, right? That's that. Good design is also unobtrusive. These digital products that we build are tools, and tools shouldn't get in the way or create more problems for people. They eliminate them. Good design is also honest. So this is a bigger topic a lot. A lot of the time we're talking about dark patterns in design. And good design is honest in the sense that it's ethical, and it doesn't try to promise users more than what it can actually deliver, and it's not using those dark patterns that are unethical. Good design is long-lasting. So today we live in a throwaway society. Things are in and out of fashion, but good design should stand the test of time. Good design is also thorough down to the last detail, so nothing should really be arbitrary. Nothing's left to chance. You just don't make a design decision because you like it, right?
Yeah,
as we just as we were just talking about, it should be data backed and it should be with intent. Getting to the end of his list here, good design is environmentally friendly, so it should minimize physical and visual pollution throughout the entire life cycle of the product. So even during your design process, through user testing, to launching it, to iterating on it, that process itself should be environmentally friendly, but the product in itself as well should also be. And lastly, good design is as little design as possible. I like to follow this model as best as I can. I like to design using a very utilitarian model, providing people just what they need without ornament or decoration. While I think branding is important and things should look nice, functionality is, in my opinion, a little more important than that.
All right. So you just mentioned about, you know, functionality being more important than look. Yeah. So there's a debate in the design circles, as you know, it's been going on for ages and ages, longer than you can ever imagine, than the rivalry of, say, the New York Jets and New England Patriots. Actually, that one's actually pretty recent. But is UX and UI separate, or are those things that are supposed to go together and you can't have one without the other? And sorry, when I say UI, I mean user interface versus user experience.
Right. So user interface design is that. It's designing user interfaces.
Mm-hmm.
If we're talking in terms of a digital product, it's going to be the screens that they interact with. If it's we're talking about more of an industrial design, like an airplane cockpit, it could be physical, tangible buttons that are the interface. That is related to user experience design, which is customer experience, which is good design. Like user experience, in my opinion, is really just that. It's good design. It's customer experience. It's even right here in this room that we're filming a podcast in, you have positioned this chair in a way that's comfortable for me. You know, this environment is set up in a way that's comforting, so that my experience here is good, is ideal. And that crosses industries and boundaries. It's not just interfaces. It's the full experience that user will say is having.
Dude, that's crucial. I really appreciate you putting the plug in to let the people know that I'm the most amazing user experience designer the world's ever seen. no. But you talked about going back to Dieter Rams. And to give you guys just one thing, Dieter Rams is 85 years old. Catch that. He's 85 years old. And the book that Nick was talking about was written about 6 years ago. So he's about 79. So to those who are losing hope, and if you're in your early 50s, late 40s, early 40s, who's losing hope in your age? Do not, because you can keep on going. A 70-year-old man wrote an amazing book that was incredibly insightful for a bunch of millennials like me. So keep the hope. You keep going. Don't let age be a boundary. Sorry, that was getting me off my soapbox. But you talked about good design is honest, and we talked about dark patterns. To those who don't understand the term of dark, what a dark pattern is, what is a dark pattern?
I think some examples of dark patterns would be pre-checking fields in forms that really should be left up to the user, with the argument being, oh, well, we're making the submission of this form easier. We know that they want to sign up for our newsletter, so we're going to check the box. It's things like positioning credit card fields in a way that promotes spending possibly unethically. It's using language that may trigger emotion in an unethical way. Those are some examples of it, but really dark patterns are just the design patterns that we use every day as designers to craft our products, but it's really a library and set of them that are arguably unethical.
Yeah, that makes a lot of sense. And to give another example of something, I know Apple Music got wrecked for it when they first released, but you know, you would sign up and you know they wouldn't let you sign up unless you gave them a credit card first. That was already problem number one, which a lot of companies do nowadays, which I personally hate. But they wouldn't let you sign up until you get a credit card. So you sign up your credit card, you go in, and you're just like, I'm doing my 30-day trial, which was a free 3-month trial, whatever it was. And at the end of 3 months, they'll start charging you. But they wouldn't give you the option to not continue after the trial. They would just automatically renew and they would start charging you. And you had to go through 3 or 4 different in-depth menus to figure out how to cancel your subscription. That's an example of a dark pattern. Them taking the power from the user. And that's something I got an
Absolutely.
Issue with.
And also giving you a 3-month trial. So by the time that the 3 months rolls around, you've forgotten that it's a free trial. And now all of a sudden you see a $7.99 charge on your credit card. And then you either have to think at that point, now there's cognitive burden on the user of, well, maybe I didn't want that. And now I'm going to have to either go submit an appeal with Apple to ask for my money back from them to cancel it, or deal with it and cancel it later. And yeah.
And you know, and I'm sorry to all of our marketer listeners, but you know that was a marketing decision to do something like that. And please, I beg you, as a user experience designer who is also delving into marketing, marketers, please do not put pressure on your user experience designers that do sketchy stuff like that. Give your power to your users. Because imagine that. You give some encouragement you give trust into your users, they'll keep coming back. You try to pull something sleazy like that, you start losing them. Imagine that.
Well, I was listening to one of your more recent vlogs. You're talking about onboarding, I believe. And like for me, in terms of onboarding, if I download an app and it's asking me to sign up or put in a credit card without giving me the ability to skip that screen and jump into the product to see what it's like first, I just immediately delete it. I don't even give it, like, I'm literally that user that they see in their analytics for 7 seconds and then deletes the app. Because that again is a dark pattern. It's no, I don't want to sign up with Facebook just to see what this app is about so that you can see what my interests are and then inform your marketing or advertising. Allow me to use the bare bones features of the app. And when I come to a spot in the app where there is maybe like I tap on the profile tab, well, you need an account to have a profile. So then prompt me to create an account and sign up. Or if I want to make a favorite and you know that favorites are saved to accounts, well, it makes sense to me as a user that then I'd be prompted to create an account in order to favorite something. But allow me to explore around before you say, give me your money or give me your information.
So virtually, I guess, going along that idea of show and don't tell.
Show and don't tell.
Yeah. Show me what I'm doing. Walk me through the app. Yeah. Don't tell me what I'm supposed to do. I guess it goes back in the whole onboarding thing, which, oh my gosh, that could be a whole other podcast in itself. You know what? I'm going to bring you back for another
podcast
just to talk onboarding, because that stuff I'm going on. I honestly, even, I guess going even talking about dark patterns and issues when it comes to user experience is the idea of notifications. I am just in the midst of writing a blog post about how a lot of companies nowadays are just using notification boxes as just spam folders. Yet again, people using something that is so beloved to just market the crap out of stuff. What are your thoughts on what's going on with the new trend with notifications and really companies kind of putting forth their agenda into notifications rather than it being something useful for the user?
Yeah, so I think you see that a lot with Facebook and Twitter. A lot of recommendations. Hey, a few of your followers liked this tweet, so you may like it too. That will appear right in your notifications inbox. I think where the argument comes in is it could be useful because you interact with these accounts, and these accounts interacted with this. You probably share the same interests, but you just don't know that you have the shared interest, so the user may get some value out of that. And I think where it is spammy is in the sense that, well, I didn't want that to happen. I know it's buried probably somewhere deep in settings and I can turn it off, but should it be opt-in or should it be opt-out? In the case of Twitter, it's a free product. You pay for it with your information, and that's the price that you pay for using a free product.
That's a good point. Yeah, because even like I just even started recently using Pinterest, and again, a lot of the same type of stuff. Like so-and-so has like 3 pins of these 3 different boards, and I'm like, I don't care about peaches and cream. Like, like, why does this matter to me? But yeah, you're right. When it comes to using a free product, I guess that's the pitfall you're gonna face.
Yeah. If you don't pay with money, you pay with your information.
So I can repeat that for the phone fans.
If you don't pay with money, you pay with your information.
Woo, that is a tough one to swallow, but that is very real.
And sometimes, a lot of the times, if the business is smart, even when you're paying with money, you're also paying with your information.
So they're going to steal your soul no matter what, ladies and gentlemen. That's the lesson learned here. So I guess kind of as we finish off here, my question to you is, how do you adapt knowledge that you've acquired in UX in the tech field and apply those to, say, other areas that you've talked about, customer experience, crossing boundaries?
Yeah. So I like to follow IDEO's human-centered design process. It's a 3-phase approach of inspiration, ideation, and implementation. And in that inspiration phase, goes back to a lot of the empathy and compassion that we were talking about before. It's actually talking to people. It's conducting problem interviews. You're you're creating assumptions at this point, and you need to go create these problem interviews to interview people and see if they're actually accurate. You know, you create falsifiable hypotheses around these to say, yes, this is true, or no, it's false, and we don't have to worry about it. And once you gather all this research from the inspiration phase, and you're actually starting to see the world through the perspective of your target audience's eyes, understanding their mental models, you can craft your actual problem from that. Like, what's the problem we're actually trying to solve? You move into the ideation phase of brainstorming products, product ideas, screens, you're sketching, you're wireframing. I have tons of ideas from there. And as you move into the implementation phase with that, that's when you're starting to hone in on one idea, iterate on it, test it, doing that user research, doing more interviews, in this case, more like usability testing, validating the assumptions that you're making, testing its viability in the market, and seeing if what you're developing is actually solving their problem and not creating more.
True. I mean, that's a good point. And I mean, IDEO is, I mean, they've been talking about design thinking forever. And I love that it started catching on in the past, you know, 4 or 5 years. And it's crucial. And if you are interested in learning more about what IDEO is talking about, even what Nick was referring to, go to IDEO.com. And that's their website. And you should really check them out and really see what they're saying and going after. Because as Nick was saying, UX, I mean, what I've learned is UX is, again, it's not limited to tech, as a lot of people seem to have that misconception, is it can affect any industry. And it's important because, as you were talking about, it's the little details that mean a lot. For example, you know, I'm so deep into this whole McGregor Mayweather fight that's coming up, and
I can see it on your Twitter feed.
Oh man, oh, I'm so pumped. There was an interview McGregor had and was doing where he was talking about, you know, where he's working at the UFC facility. That's where he's been training, and it's a beautiful facility. And one of the questions was, you know, how has it been training? He's like, it's great. Like, just even the little details of, there's always a fresh towel here ready to go. You know, I'm grateful for all of it. I love it. But that really hit me. I'm like, that's UX right there. Like, you think about the little details that will mean something, as we'll see in other in upcoming episodes. Like, other designers that I've been talking to have brought up different stories where the little details are what means a lot and will bring a customer back. When you care for the customer, they will come back. When they find that you're just trying to siphon value out of them, it never goes well. And they will probably come back maybe a second time, but they won't be a repeat customer. So, hey, have you any closing thoughts, Nick? Anything you want to let the people know?
Just another quick note on that human-centered design. IDEO also has a free course right on their website, Introduction to Human-Centered Design. I recommend anyone interested in learning more about design thinking and their methodology to take a look at that. I took that course a couple years ago, and it covers exactly what you were referencing across industry. They use it for anything between designing an interface like what we're doing, or flying to third world countries and understanding what the impacts of trying to do something such as implement irrigation into a village, how that impacts people. And you can use these same methodologies across industry as they so well do.
Fantastic. I absolutely love UX, and I love that it branches over across boundaries, and it's so important. But that comes to the end of our time. Nick, you're such an awesome dude, and I know all the people that are listening want to know who you are. So where can we find you on social media, and where can we have those conversations and continue talking?
Yeah. If you punch in Google NN Woodman, you can find me there on Twitter, on Instagram. I've been using that handle for a while now, so I like quite literally own like the first 4 pages of Google with NN Woodman. You can find me there. Yeah.
Perfect, man. Thank you for your time. Thank you for your insight. And thank you for all those who are listening. Check you on the flip side.